Dave Crippen,
with another one of our series of interviews with well-known automotive designers. And this is July 31st, 1984, and we are at the Henry Ford Archives of the Henry Ford Museum. And today we're talking with Mr. Alden Gibb Giberson, who was with Ford for 30 years or more as a designer, and we will ask Mr. Giberson to tell his story in his own way.
Well, thank you, Dave. How's the level on there, okay? Right. For my voice? How's the level on that for my voice, okay?
Very good.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Dave.
Mm-hmm.
We'll just take a shot at this. Well, when I was a kid, I was around 12 in the teens there. I was interested in airplanes a lot, and I used to build a lot of model airplanes. Now, I always used to like to draw airplanes. So I thought I wanted to be an aeronautical engineer. So when I went to Cass Tech, and I took aeronautical engineering at Cass Tech. And I fully thought that was going to be my profession, but I, because I continued to draw airplanes and build airplanes, and it was a good hobby. So I always wanted to get into radio control, but I never did. Never had the money. But anyway, I got out of Cass Tech and I went right in the Army, and so I tried to get in the Air Corps, but I couldn't because I got something wrong with my back. So when I went in the Army, I thought, well, maybe I can get in the ground crew, anything to be around airplanes. So they put me in anti-aircraft.
This was World War II.
Two,
of course.
Yeah. 1944. Mm-hmm. So I was in there for a while, but well, nothing much happened there. I did take a couple of flying lessons, which I was taking before when I was going to Cass Tech. Come to think of it, I was going to another school, an aero mechanics school at the end of the runway out at City Airport.
In Detroit.
We used to lay out on the end of the runway and eat our lunch, and that little police car would come out and chase us off. But after the Army and I came back, I went up to U of M and got into engineering. And I stayed in that a couple of years, and I didn't seem to be doing very well. So I switched over to architecture, and then I was having some trouble in school, and I finally wound up coming back to Dearborn Junior College and sort of getting into a few art courses. And then eventually, for some reason or other, I got married. And went to work with my dad at Smith Hinchman & Grills. He was chief designer at that time. And but I figured I still wanted to get into some kind of artwork. I guess I still like to draw airplanes. So I took a few art courses at Meinzinger Art School and Allen Airbrush School. And I fooled around with that for a while. And
where was Allen?
Allen Airbrush was in the old convention hall.
Oh, yes.
Was on either on Forest or Warren. I don't remember
Warren,
where that was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Meinzinger was over on Woodward, mm-hmm. right about the same place.
Meinzinger, how do you spell that?
M-E-I-N-Z-I-N-G-E-R, I guess.
Yeah.
Or yeah, M-I-E-N.
Design and art schools.
Yeah, I think quite a few of the fellows at Ford had gone to Meinzinger. Of course, the really top-notch ones went to Art Center.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, a good friend of mine was Bill Brathen, and
B-R-A-A-T-H-E-N.
And I knew him from when I was younger over on the east side of Detroit, and then. Then he went with Ford, and I think he was in the product, what was it? Oh, I forgot. It was like administrative stuff, mostly clerical work, I think.
At
At Ford Motor Company.
And he was right next to, well, he was connected with the styling, I guess, over at the Triple E building there, but he wasn't a designer or anything. But he got intrigued with this styling business, and he started to make some renderings of cars. And we were out at his house one night, his house. It was some kind of barracks they had built across Middle Belt from the airport out there, and they were all terrible things, but they were livable. Something like that, yeah. And I saw these things that he was making, these car designs, and I thought, I said to him, I said, I can do that. I can do that stuff. I just never drew cars. I drew other stuff. So I went home and I made some renderings too. I probably had a half a dozen of them. And he had already taken his in and got a job. I think he was making $298 a month, as I recall.
Mm-hmm. Where was he working?
In the design center. Yeah, he went to, Bill Schmidt hired him in. I mean, transferred him from one department to the other. And I got in about a month later. Frank Hershey hired me in. And I got a big kick out of the fact because in the meantime, they had had some kind of a raise or something, and I hired in for 3 1/4. So I was making more than Bill for some reason or other.
What year was this?
1952. So we were both working in there for a long time. And we always used to be together all the time. They used to call us the Gold Dust Twins. But I went into advanced styling with Gil Spear. And at that time, he was working on, his pet project was the retractable hardtop, which I guess Bill Ford was pretty interested in.
And this is still in 52, 53?
52, 53, yeah. Mm-hmm. 52, mostly. Mm-hmm. And they had a little tent size clay model that they had. It worked with a little crank. You could make the top go up and down. And they were making a 3/8 scale model, which worked with the little motors and stuff that was being made in the metal shop.
Really? Wow.
And that was really a nice thing. Mm-hmm. That their retractable hardtop was, of course, they finally wound up making it in 57. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have anything to do with that. I had a little bit to do with 57 Ford, but not that. So,
what were you doing? What were your first duties when you signed in?
Well,
kind of things?
The original advanced styling was more a place where they put the young fellows who come in to sort of get accustomed to production work. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty loose in the beginning. You were pretty free to do almost anything you wanted to do, right, as long as it was within reason. Mm-hmm. And so some of the stuff was pretty far out, like some of it didn't have wheels and things like that. But evidently, after, I think it was probably 3 months or so, Bob McGuire and Dave Ash seemed to like my work quite well, and they put me in the Ford studio. Mm-hmm. So.
Was that to your liking? Did you?
Oh, yeah, that was fine, exactly what I wanted.
Good.
Fine, yeah. It's kind of funny, the reason Frank Hershey hired me in was because, well, it wasn't really, my work was good.
Sure.
But it certainly didn't hurt that I had the New Mexico state symbol in the hubcaps of all my cars.
you probably should go back and explain why you have that.
Well, that's true. Before I went with Ford, and I was working with my father in the Los Alamos Atomic Energy Project down in New Mexico.
Now, you say he was a city planner?
He was what they called the town planner. He worked for W.C. Kruger Company. And what he did, he was in charge of the non-tech areas, mm-hmm, or the residential areas,
right,
and
for the scientists to live in.
Right.
Yeah.
And anything that wasn't a tech area. The tech area buildings were mostly temporary anyway.
Yeah.
But Los Alamos originally was a boys' school, and it was all log buildings down there.
Mm-hmm.
And the one dormitory building, which was probably, was quite a large building. It must have been 80 feet by 30 feet, something like that. And it was, as I recall, was the largest vertical log building, at least in the United States anyway, but it was vertical logs.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had the lodge there. That was horizontal logs. That had a kitchen and a dining room and a big dining room and rooms for where the parents would go and stay when they were visiting their boys, I guess.
Oh.
And
the boys' prep school.
I never did really figure out exactly what kind it was, but it was a boys' school. And my wife and I met Oppenheimer one night at dinner. We sat at we all sat at big tables and had dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And this one night we were there, and everybody had to tell what they did for a living.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody did. And I remember he got up and he said he was a physicist. And I said, "Well, what is that? What?" I didn't know him from Adam, you know. But and I didn't really know who he was till years later.
Mm-hmm. But you had met him.
Yeah.
Yeah. You knew basically what was going on there, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. They used to have test explosions every Tuesday and Thursday in the canyons down there, but they weren't atomic. They were simulated with dynamite or whatever they used.
Testing triggers.
I suppose so. And they had, you could only take walks up into the mountains on Sundays, and you had to stay within certain guidelines. You couldn't go off one way or the other. They had contaminated sewers in the canyon. You couldn't go down there. But that's where I got the background for the Thunderbird name, anyway, was from down there, because Thunderbird was on everything.
Part of the state and regional lore, was it?
Oh, definitely.
Stemming from the Indian earlier settlers.
Yeah, we used to drive from Los Alamos to Santa Fe, which was about 35 miles, to go to stores and things like that, because there wasn't much up in the Los Alamos project. And on the way, there was two formations on a mountain, which were really blank spots in the trees on the sides of the mountain. They were all pine and aspen, things like that. And one of the blank spots was they called the Horse's Head, and I always could see that. But there was another one called the Thunderbird, and I never really made that one out. I couldn't figure it out now. But I was always intrigued with it, maybe because I could never see it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But anyway, getting back to Ford again, I think one of the first projects I got when I got into the Ford studio was a little plastic medallion on the rear quarter of the roof on the 1954 Ford, I forgot what they called it, the one with the plastic roof. It was the first car with the plastic roof, 1954 Ford.
Sunliner, Skyliner?
The front, probably. I think that they called the convertible a Sunliner, so it was probably the Skyliner or something like that.
Yeah. Mm.
And
later appropriated for the retractable hardtops.
Well, no, they never really used a plastic roof on the retractable.
No, but the name, Skyliner.
Oh, Skyliner, yeah, right, I see. Yeah, that's true. But that's plastic roof was really nice. I had a 55 Crown Victoria with a plastic roof, and my wife still thinks that's the greatest car we ever had.
There were reports that there were problems on very hot days that magnified the heat, the sun.
Well, it was heavily tinted, and
One year it was clear, sorry. Maybe the first year was clear, second year was tinted.
Well, it may be that some of the first models might have been clear, but the later 54s were tinted.
Definitely.
And then in the 55, and of course 56, they had a nylon screen that you could pull out of the sort of roll bar thing that went over the basket handle, they called it. You could pull out of that and zip it all the way around, and that helped quite a bit. But it's true, it was very hot when the sun was shining.
Yeah.
But it was a fantastic thing to sit in when there was a thunderstorm with lightning.
Oh,
I mean,
that.
Look up, it was great.
Yeah. Did you have any input into that?
I worked plastic hardtop. I worked quite a bit on the 1955 Ford grill.
Mm.
And my forte at that time, I seemed to get a reputation for doing taillights, so I did the taillights on, I think it was the 55, 56, and 57 Ford, and maybe the 58 too, I don't know. I don't remember.
You did the 55 grill?
I worked with Joe Orris on that.
It was my first new car.
Really? It was our first new car, too.
Well, that's right, that's true.
Before that, I had the MG, which was MGTD, which was nice. Well, let's see.
Well, what was the atmosphere in 55, say? Or 50, say you're working on 55 Ford, about 53.
Well, the thing I remember most was the attitude of the stylists. was just, they were excited, really excited about when the new cars came out. Everybody charged up to the Chevrolet dealer, the Oldsmobile dealer, wherever, to see the new cars.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they do that anymore. They're not very exciting now. But every year, that was a big project,
mm-hmm.
to charge out and climb the fence if you had to get a look at these new cars.
Well,
some of them were pretty stupid.
About your colleagues?
Yes.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, I wouldn't do that, no. Yeah, there wasn't Les Stanford up there. There was somebody else.
Yeah,
then
I
forgot what the name was. Yeah. But the spirit was just so fantastic, and the loyalty to Ford was utterly unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing like what it is now.
Who do you think was responsible for that, outside of Henry Ford II,
as a
symbol?
That helped a little bit. Being a family business did help.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot different, I think, than working for General Motors, which was so non-personal.
Mm-hmm.
And you did get to see Henry once in a while, and William Clay. I remember one time when I was in the advanced studio, William Clay, I'd been there probably a week,
mm-hmm.
and he came up to the door to come in, and they always kept the doors locked. And I opened the door, and I saw this young fellow out there with his sleeves rolled up and his tie undone, and I said, "You can't come in here." And there was some other guy with him who I didn't know, and of course, Gil Spear came over and let him in, and then I found out it was William Clay Ford, and the other one was, I think, the chief engineer at the time, McPherson, I think.
Oh,
it was.
Aaron
so somebody,
McPherson.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, I learned fast.
Oh, yeah.
But
it was a fascinating time to be in the design.
It
studio.
Really was, and even though some of the designs, especially when they got into the 58s and 59s, got to look pretty stupid.
Mm-hmm.
The 59 Chevrolet, I remember. I guess it was in 57 or 58. They modeled it. They made a model, clay model of it. And nobody could believe it, that anybody would do anything as stupid looking as that. They took it up to the showroom and everyone laughed at it. And I thought, well, somebody's let out some fake blueprints or something there. But then it came out and that's the way it looked. Couldn't believe it. Yeah, well, the 59 Ford didn't look all that great either.
Yeah, they trimmed it a bit, but it was still pretty bad.
They stuck the Thunderbird roof on.
Yeah.
Well, the Thunderbird was an interesting project, too.
Were you drawn into that early on?
I got it when I was in the Ford studio for, I don't remember, not more than a few months, it seems like.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were still in the Triple E building. I don't think we moved over to the new building till 53.
Mm-hmm.
And in there, I got pulled out to Bill Boyer's studio, which was under Damon Woods, which was, I think, either advanced or pre-production. It was pre-production, I guess they called it. And they were working on the Thunderbird in there, and I got put on the interior of that. I was doing working on the interior. And then all the other fellows were doing full-size renderings of exteriors. And it was an interesting model in that was the only model I ever worked on, or know of. There were a couple after that, but this was the first one where the interior was modeled in the same modeling armature as the exterior.
Oh.
So while
first,
the,
you think?
Well, it was the first that I knew of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there were modelers working on the outside of the car and modelers working on the inside of the car at the same time.
All in one piece.
Mm-hmm. And
By an armature, you mean what?
Well, the clay armature, that they call them bucks. What the wood armature that they just throw the hot clay on and build it on. But they did have to make the things like the doors thicker than usual because of the fact they needed enough armature to hold this heavy clay. So the actual dimensions of the car weren't exactly right, at least on the inside. Basically, what the car wound up with was a 1954 instrument panel, Ford instrument panel, made a little bit hotter. I forget exactly what they did. They put more instruments in it and things like that. Put some engine turning on it. on the for decoration.
These are tacks, as I recall, tachometer.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the door panels were quite innovative. They had a really swashy armrest on them, and had engine turning decoration on the door panel too. It was the seats were pretty normal, as I recall. But all in all, it looked like it was going to be a pretty nice car. Nobody believed they were going to really make it.
Mm-hmm.
And
just another advanced model, someone thought.
Yeah, it would. Everybody thought it would really be nice if they could do it. And the aim was to make it. I think it was weigh around 2,500 pounds and cost about $2,500.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how, if they hit the weight mark, but I think they hit the price mark. It was about $2,500. But in the first stages of that, I don't remember, everybody just called it the sports car or something, whatever they felt like calling it. And of course they had many different names on the thing. Every different rendering had a name proposal on it. And I think, well, I had this damn coffee cup around that I brought back from New Mexico, and it had a Thunderbird emblem on it.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason or other, I thought that would be a good name for the car. So I sort of was pushing it a little bit, and I think I mentioned it to Frank Hershey, and he thought it might be a good name too, but they weren't anywhere near picking a name anyway, so.
Was Hershey one of the design executives on that car, too?
Hershey was, in my recollection, Frank Hershey was in the chief designer, or whatever they called it, of the Ford styling,
right.
And Bill Schmidt was chief designer of Lincoln Mercury,
right.
And over them was Charlie Waterhouse,
mm-hmm.
who was...
He hadn't left yet, huh?
No, he hadn't left yet. No, he stayed there after we moved in a new building, too.
As a design administrative head?
I don't remember what his title was, but it was the same as what Walker took over later.
Uh-huh. How about Victor Raviolo at that time? Was he
an
engineer?
Yeah, he was an engineer. I forgot all about him. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did not have to think hard on that one, but I do remember him having quite a bit to do with some stuff. Sometime.
I think he and Waterhouse were relatively equal in different spheres.
Evidently.
In terms of administration. Yeah.
Uh-huh. I do remember when we'd have a show, it would be, he was certainly involved in the mm-hmm. decision-making there. Yeah.
What sort of input did Bourdonnais have into the Thunderbird?
None that I know.
None whatsoever.
No.
It wasn't this kind of car.
No, well, he was in Lincoln Mercury. He was under Schmidt. He and another fellow, I forgot his name.
Did he work for Bill? Bill
Bourdonnais worked for Bill Schmidt.
Bill Schmidt.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. I think the big thing about the Thunderbird, as far as I'm concerned, and I might as well get this out of the way, is that somehow or other, I kept pushing this Thunderbird and the emblem and stuff like that, and finally, people began to, they knew what the symbol meant when I saw it on my drawing board. I kept drawing these things.
Mm-hmm, right.
And I was drawing with two heads, which is the one on the cup had two heads. And people would come up and say, well, that looks dumb with two heads, and why don't you make one with one head? And they'd tell me how to make it, and it kept coming out looking like an eagle or the NRA symbol that used to be for, because I did some with clasped lightning and all this stuff.
Uh-huh, right.
But anyway, somehow, I don't know how it happened, but
I guess the old NRA symbol had a gear in one hand and
lightning.
Lightning in the other claw.
Then my recollection was,
yeah. That's correct. Yeah, right.
And somehow, it finally got wound up on the car, on the models. And I guess it was on most of the models. And it was sort of accepted that that was at least the name they were going to have until they thought of something better, anyway.
Code name.
You could look at it that way.
Yeah.
But we had developed pretty much some medallions and the script for the side of the car. And then they had a big show one day. It was in the warm weather, I remember, in the summer probably, 83, I guess, or 53, I guess. And they had Henry Ford II out there and Ernie Breech and Crusoe and I don't know if McNamara was out there too.
This is over here.
Over in the courtyard.
In the styling.
Before it was paved, when it was mostly grass.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't so damn hot out there.
Mm.
And after that show, the cars, the models of the T-Bird came back with no emblems or names on them.
Oh, really?
And somebody said that Henry hadn't liked it. Mm. But I don't know if that's true or not, really. Anyway, so we went along for a long time without a name, and they had people submitting names, and Crusoe wanted to call it El Tigre, and Dave Ash wanted to call it Deneb, which I thought was a fantastically stupid name.
What did that mean?
It's a star. D-E-N-E-B.
Deneb.
I thought, Deneb, yeah. I thought, well, that's a dumb name. Dave usually came up with good names, but he... That was a bad one. And somebody else wanted to call it Coronado, which...
Wasn't too bad.
Well, the Corvette was already out, though, and I thought that was too close to that, really.
Yeah.
I don't think they
ever...
It did have
a western tinge to it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Ken Nelson had a good name, I thought, Lightning Rod.
Yeah.
Was, the hot rods were really popular then. Right. He was from California. He was a hot rodder out there.
Uh-huh.
And he refinished cars out there, too.
Uh-huh.
He's down in Florida now.
Is he?
I think he's chief designer for something or other down there.
Check him out.
He retired and went to Seattle, and then he moved back.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, things went along, and they had a bunch of names on the car. And
were you still pushing Thunderbird?
No, I gave up.
You gave up on it.
One day, Frank Hershey called me up on the phone, and he said, can you give me some background on Thunderbird? I need it right away. We're going to have a press release. And I said, I thought they chucked the name. I didn't. He said, I got to have it right now. So I said, I don't know anything about it. I just told him what little I knew about it from down there. And he was from he was down in Taos, so he knew as much about it as I did.
Yeah, yeah.
He was, I don't know what he was doing down there. That was an art colony. Maybe he was down there. Gil Trewick. One of the head modelers was down there too.
Oh, really?
Not at the time Frank Hershey was,
uh-huh.
but later. So anyway, that's how the name got on the car. They just did it. And I read in the Automobile Quarterly later that evidently GM had picked the name up,
mm-hmm.
and that they beat him to the punch by a day or so, I guess. And so though they had to call their car the Firebird. That show car that they were bringing
right,
up.
Uh-huh.
So I guess that's what happened there, at least that's what it says in the book.
As I recall, the first release had a lot of pseudo-lore about Thunderbird. Did you help him with that at all? Was that some of the stuff you'd given to Frank Hershey?
I don't recall what I told Frank. I told him what I knew about it, which was very little.
Mm-hmm. Of course, but like you said, he was from Taos, so he knew
He really knew. He didn't have to call me.
Yeah.
So I told him it had two wings, and I was looking at the one on my cup and say, well, that's it. But there were a lot of different versions of it down there, too. Even all the little souvenir shops in Santa Fe had Rainbow Men and Thunderbirds and all kinds of things with feathers on them and stuff. But, of course, there was one thing, and with the Thunderbird, it seemed to be related to turquoise. So, on the emblems, we always use turquoise for a color.
Certainly, that's the color. Was and is the prevalent color down in the tourist area.
There's so much turquoise jewelry down there, and silver, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Then I found out that Frank Hershey told me that Lou Crusoe had decided to give anybody who named the car a $250 suit.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, that was okay, but what I'd like is a car, or at least a discount on one anyway. Because at that time I was in a position where I didn't get a discount on anything. So I had this $250 suit coming, and Wendell Clough, I think, who was Crusoe's assistant or something.
How do you spell his last name?
C-L-O-U-G-H.
Clough.
Wendell Clough.
Right. You know?
Said I had this $250 suit coming, and I could go any place I wanted to get it. So Frank Hershey told me the name of his tailor, Disner's. I should go there. So I went there first, and it was really embarrassing, all the places I went, because As it turned out, the most expensive suit I could get, any way you wanted to get it, was a cashmere suit. And it didn't make any difference whether it was off the rack or handmade or whatever. It was $173.
Those were the days.
That was it. See, unless you got one like Elvis Presley with sequins on it or something like that, you couldn't make it above 173. And there wasn't any way. So I came back and I told Frank, I've been all over, and there's no way I can get a suit for more than $173. And so he said, well, why don't you buy a whole wardrobe? Get a hat, shoes, and all that stuff. So I said, well, that I could do that, you know. So I went back and priced all that out, and I bring it back, and I talked to Frank, and Frank says, fine. And I talked to Wendell Pluff and says, nope, you've got to get a $250 suit. That's what Lou Crusoe said. And I kept doing this, and there was no agreement at all. I finally wound up saying to myself, okay, let's say I got a suit with two pair of pants. That would be reasonable. That would be one suit. So I wound up going to Saks. I got a $95 suit and a $45 pair of slacks. And they were nice.
Yeah.
At that time, that was quite a nice suit.
Sure.
And then the embarrassing part came again. When the suit was ready, and I didn't have the money. They hadn't given me the money. And it had been about, 10 days or so. So I called Saks and I said, well, I couldn't make it this week. I'll try next week. In the meantime, I was trying to get the money from them, and I couldn't get it.
Plus, there's no money without it, the showing me the suit.
Well, 3 weeks went by, and Saks was getting a little disturbed. So I finally had to go in and explain to them what the situation was, and then they
understood.
It was unusual, but they understood, but it was embarrassing again. One of the most embarrassing things was going in to buy a suit and have somebody show you all these materials, like Harris tweeds.
Yes.
And I'd look through them all and I think, well, that's really nice. Anyway, how much is this one? 125. And I'd have to say, well, do you have anything more expensive? Well, you can go to cashmere, it's 173. So that's the way it went, anyway.
That's marvelous. Where did you finally get the suit?
Saks.
Yeah.
Saks.
Was it a good cashmere suit?
No, it wasn't cashmere. That cashmere was 173. I only spent 95.
Oh,
it was ridiculous,
right,
for me to get a cashmere suit because I had the MGTD.
Oh, yes.
And every time you get in the car, you drag your clothes over to the running board on that thing. And, of course, a lot of times you had to work on it because it didn't always work every minute of the day.
Yeah.
So I didn't want a cashmere suit, number one. And that was about the story on that.
So, in effect, you were the person who named the Thunderbird. That is, in a sense, you gave them the inspiration for the name.
That's my big history at
that's
the Ford
right.
Motor Company.
Yeah, marvelous.
Other than that, it's been all bits and pieces.
Did you talk to Crusoe about it at all?
No, I almost called him one night when I got so mad. And I did call, and the line was busy, and that saved me, probably. But I was going to explain what the stupid situation was, because I had spent probably a month going to all these clothing stores, and it really got to the... With every one of them, I'd have to explain what was going on, because they'd think I was some kind of a nut.
Sure.
Don't you have anything... You got anything for $250? And when I'd explain it to them, they'd say, well, why don't you get a whole wardrobe? And I'd say, well, I can't. I couldn't do it. They were really immovable on that.
Uh-huh. How long did you keep the suit?
Oh, it lasted a long time.
Okay.
I don't remember.
Yeah.
A long time. Mm-hmm. When I got it, finally, it had been such a big to-do that Chase Morsey, he was... I don't know if you know Chase Morsey.
I've heard of it, yeah.
He had a pretty good job at that time. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was product planning or something like that.
Yeah.
He damn near insisted that I go up to the showroom and stand on the turntable and they have a show on the suit. But fortunately, it wound up that I walked to the one end of the studio and everybody looked at it, and that was about it. Very embarrassing.
And of course, Clough reported to Crusoe that you had gotten the suit. And
oh, yeah, yeah. I don't think Crusoe ever saw it, not that he knew of. I'm sure he saw it, but... it was funny.
That must have been, yeah.
But after that, that was the most notable thing there.
Mm-hmm.
After that, then Let's see, when did I get into after that? I guess I started working on the 57 Ford. Had quite a bit to do with the grill on that, and the taillights, again, always the taillights.
Mm-hmm. That was one of your specialties.
Yeah, that was the first, the first taillight I did with the backup light in the middle of it was the 56 taillight. That was the first one.
That was beautiful.
Where they had the backup light in the middle, and which was interesting because you had to run the wire from the backup light through the taillight in a way that you didn't see it when the light lit up. And in other words, it was going to cast a shadow. There was no way it couldn't cast a shadow, but you had to put it in a place where it wouldn't be too noticeable.
Big fat ones, sir.
They're not the 56 so much. The 57 was the big round one. That was huge. And at that time, I think it was a little over 7 inches, which at that time seemed huge. That one, we just made no bones about the shadow of the wire. We just made it go straight down, and that was it. Just showed up, and that was it.
Many of your colleagues speak of the term
bezel. Bezel, yeah.
What could you, in terms of taillights or headlights, exactly what is that? Is it, how do you spell it, by the way?
Well, B-E-Z-E-L, but I think that's probably as nebulous as escutcheon. But a bezel is, well, for instance, in I think in the parts books they call the frame around the decorative frame around the headlight it the headlight frame,
mm-hmm.
but we used to call it the headlight bezel.
Ah, okay.
And the taillight bezel, so mm-hmm. it would be the rim or right. frame around the if there was a little ring around an instrument or something like that on the interior, it would be the bezel.
Do you know what the derivation of that term, have you ever thought about where it came from?
Good grief, no. No, I never thought about that. I wonder if it's French or something like that.
I wonder if it.
I don't know. Never questioned it. Never questioned escutcheon either, but I suppose that's from heraldry, probably.
I think so, yeah.
Not a matter of design, it was a matter of stuffing them in, really. The first double headlights in the 58 Ford, we had to stuff them in the same space as the 57 was in. 57 was had one headlight, and the 58, they decided, well, the competition was going to have two, so we had to stuff two headlights in there.
Now, how did you do that?
Well, just jam them as close together as you can get.
Were they round?
Two round headlights. Yeah, they had that. The smaller headlights, I forget the dimension of them, they went to the two smaller headlights, and they just barely fit, they bulged out the side a little bit. So they went the dual taillights on that one too. I don't remember, one went up with the trunk lid, I think.
Was that 57?
The inboard, 58. 58,
oh, the inboard went up with the trunk lid.
As I recall, yeah.
Another squeeze.
Yeah, and the... I don't know what they did on the station wagon. There was a problem there. They might have had to go to singles. I don't remember.
When did backup lights come in generally?
Well, they were there when I went there in 52.
There's
but they were
in 52.
They were accessories.
Or then you had to buy them.
They were.
Or order them.
They were not 50. They were separate from the taillights. I'm trying to remember, I think they were below the taillights, and sometimes they were mounted on the shield between the bumper and the body.
Later in the upper triangle, as I recall, above the taillight.
That's right. Yeah. In the 50...
Sort of ribbed glass.
55, that was where the backup light went when you got a backup light. That's right.
Yeah. So I had one of those. Yeah.
And then in 56, they put it in the center of the taillight.
Yeah, that's right.
So you didn't have to do that. That's right. That 1955 taillight and that little finial up on the top with the backup light in it was the design that they picked up, of course, for the Thunderbird.
Yes.
That was basically the rear end of the Thunderbird with a unique bumper.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the 1954 instrument panel and the 1955 headlamp bezel off the 55 Ford.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the grill was unique and the hood was unique and all that stuff.
Speaking of the Thunderbird, they use those little cross racing flags on the front fender. Who Whose idea was that? Do you remember offhand?
No, I don't. If I were to guess, I'd probably say Dave Ash or somebody.
Was he a racing enthusiast? Right?
Oh, yeah. He had an MG, too.
Oh, he did?
Also.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
He had a TC.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was, in fact, he had checkered flags on his TC, too. He took the checkered flags and put them on there, too.
That's right. They were both checkered flags, weren't they? Yeah.
It was on either side. And one time, it seems to me, it was on the hood, too.
Was it really?
I don't remember.
Early
oh, well, there was a period where checkered flags went on everything, cross-checkered flags. I remember one cross-checkered flags with crossed lightning underneath them.
Really?
Hard to beat that.
You can't beat that for symbolism. Were you able to get the lightning bolts in the Thunderbird ornament?
I had any way you could think of a Thunderbird ornament, I had it.
Mm-hmm.
With the wings up and the wings down and or horizontal, and some of them had lightning bolts, but the one they bought, the original that they bought for the car wasn't didn't have any lightning bolts in it. Didn't it was really, really a sort of a an eagle that was made to look simplified, like an Indian might designate an eagle. But they had it every place. They had it on the, they had that emblem on the valve covers. And then you could buy special valve covers that were cast aluminum and finned, and that had the emblem on it. Of course, on the instrument panel. let's see, not too much exciting. Let's see what happened. Oh, in 1960, I was in charge of, some interior pre-production, and we did the first cove rear seat. Remember the cove rear seat in the 64th Thunderbird?
Right.
But we did that down in pre-production. Jimmy Quinlan and I worked on that, and the front seat was really a unique seat too.
Can you characterize those seats in layman's terms?
Well, the rear seat we were doing a clay model in the pre-production interior there, and we did a what we called a cove seat. Instead of a individual COV or COVE or COVED coved seat, like a booth in a restaurant that goes around, surrounds you, yes. So in effect, instead of having two individual seat cushions in the back, you sat back there like you were in a booth in a restaurant, and the seat came around to the side of you. Theoretically, you could sit sideways, but of course you couldn't because of the configuration of the car. There was a tunnel hump in the middle, so you couldn't really do that. But it gave the impression of coming around. And I don't think there was too much chance of getting that seat made. Except George Walker decided he liked it.
Uh-huh.
And so the trim shop made one up and proved that it could be done.
Uh-huh.
And then it pretty much got taken almost right out of our model into the 64 Thunderbird, almost as is. Also the front seats, which were kind of unique in the fact that they were only had, as I recall, three small pleats running down the back and the cushion in the center, and then the outside of the seat was just plain, which was really unique for that time. Jimmy Quinlan had a lot to do with that.
Yeah. Back to the earlier Thunderbird, in the 60s, the decision was made to go to a four-seater.
Oh, 58.
Or 58, yeah. Were you privy to any of that?
No, I had nothing to do with it except to voice my disapproval, which Joe Orris was really pushing that.
Oh, was he?
I probably somebody else was, too.
Yeah.
But Joe, and as I recall, Bill Boyer had a lot to do with that first four-seater.
Oh, did he?
Mm-hmm. Well, I know Joe Orris did.
Mm-hmm.
And
did they think there was a market for it, obviously?
Oh, evidently there was. It sold like crazy.
Yeah.
And that lasted, and that body style lasted until the 64 came. Oh, wait a minute. This 60 was a body style change. That's right. That was when they went to the more aerodynamic one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Was Lee Iacocca on the scene by 54 in any strong capacity?
No, I think he was still with Truck or something.
Still with Truck.
At least,
just
yeah.
Come on, I think, a couple of years before.
Yeah.
So Crusoe, it was really Crusoe's car. He's
yeah.
one of the people
oh.
who wanted that sport car, wasn't he?
Yeah, Crusoe.
Louis Crusoe.
It's kind of interesting. There's one. This has really nothing too much to do with the Thunderbird, except for the fact that this side treatment was on the side of the car for a while. That big swash treatment off the 55 Ford, the thing that came from the top of the fender down the side like a big check mark.
Apparently, that was Crusoe's passion, wasn't it?
I always attributed that to McNamara, that he put it on the side of the Thunderbird.
Uh-huh.
But, of course, it came off anyway.
Yeah,
but that it was interesting where the swash came from. Ken Nelson designed that for the side treatment for the 55 Ford.
Uh-huh.
And then they made a show car that was based on that side treatment. It was called the Mystère that Bill Boyer did. And the whole theme of the car was this...
T-E-R-E.
Right. The whole theme of this car was this big check mark side treatment, which came from the top of the front fender down over the side and then hopped back up over the rear wheel. But then they thought, well, they showed the show car, and then the 55 Ford came out, so they said that was from the Mystère. But actually, it was just the other way around.
That's interesting. I hadn't heard that story.
Not too exciting, really.
Well, in the terms of dream cars and translating it into production cars, it's really the story of the 50s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got sent to... I was sent to England in 1960.
Did you?
To train somebody to take over the interior department. The fellow who had interiors over there had left.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a man, a good man, to take it over, but he hadn't had much experience in that area.
At this time, you were pretty much an interior.
I was pretty much in interiors at that time, but I'd say over the years, it was about 50-50. I kept going back and forth.
Uh-huh.
Nobody wanted me, or else everybody wanted me, one or the other. But I went over, and I was given the task of training John Fallis.
Oh, really?
Who I found, as far as I was concerned, didn't need any training.
How do you spell his last name?
Fallis. Fallis, not Phallus.
Right.
Although he would like to think that.
He would have preferred that.
Yeah, he was a...
A ladies' man.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, that was an interesting experience going over there. For me, the one who was over there, who I was sent over to work, he was a
ladies' man.
Yes.
Well,
that was an interesting experience going over there. The one who was over there, who I was sent over to work for, was Roy Brown, who designed the Edsel.
Right. Uh-huh.
And Roy was the chief designer over there.
Mm-hmm.
So I was there only on a temporary basis, really, until John Fallis could take over, which only took about 3 months, really. I don't think it would have taken that long. I just stretched it out.
Mm-hmm. Everybody seemed to enjoy the tour of duty in England.
We enjoyed it, and... We got to stay in an interesting house over there. It was a Muse flat. I don't know if you know what those are. So it was
MEWS.
It was in effect the old stable house behind the mansion.
Right.
On the alley, and it had been converted into a home. And of course, they all had on this one Muse. I suppose all the Muses in London have been converted to houses by this time.
Let's saw after.
But the one we had was the. Owned by Mary Churchill.
Oh, really?
And she had...
the daughter of Winston.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And she had married a Dutch diplomat.
Oh.
And they were going to the south of France to build a house, and they wanted to rent this out, so we rented it out.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a lot of sculptures that was done by John Churchill in there, and a lot of beautiful artwork.
Who was John?
Oh, I don't remember, but he still lived in London. I remember having to take one of the sculptures up to his house. Mm-hmm. He had a Muse flat, but he had painted cast iron balconies around all the windows.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really a weird looking thing.
Painted them?
Painted flowers on it. It all really a weird. I walked up there and I thought, hey, I don't know about this guy. It was interesting. My wife would get a call from Lady Churchill almost every other day.
Hadn't forgotten the number.
No, she'd call and ask when Mary was coming home. When is Mary coming home? My wife would tell her. She didn't know.
This Clementine Churchill?
Oh, was that her name?
Yeah, I got it.
Oh. No, my wife always
Clemmy,
called.
Clemmy.
Oh, maybe. Yeah. My wife always called him Lady Churchill, and then Lady Jane used to come out to the house once in a while too, for some unknown reason. I guess Anne Baxter had rented it before we did.
Frank Lloyd Wright's
year before.
Granddaughter.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I found out later. Yeah.
My father hated Frank Lloyd Wright. So naturally I did too.
So your house had quite a celebrity status.
Oh, yeah. It did. It was number 8, Lennox Gardens Mews. And we'd have maid. Maid came with it. We had to take the maid.
Oh, my.
Cost the fantastic fantastic sum of 34 cents an hour.
Oh my God.
She was every day except Sunday, I think.
Mm.
Mrs. Davies. She used to smoke player's weights. Those little short cigarettes?
Yeah.
She is an interesting character.
Uh-huh.
Well, my son was only 7 years old then, or six or seven. We had to keep him from going to first grade a little bit there, but just for 3 months it wasn't bad. He went back later on his own on a bike trip.
Really?
When he was about 17, I think, and spent a month all over and went to France and around.
What a great adventure.
Yeah, he'd like to go back again.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to go back. We went back in 1968, I think it was, to visit Bob Thomas.
Oh, yes.
Who was working over there at the time. And
working in Fort Bingham.
Right. He was executive stylist of exteriors or interiors, I forgot which.
Mm-hmm.
They had a nice house over there too, so we spent a couple of weeks over there. I didn't do any design work over there then.
Yeah. What did you do for Ford and Fellis when you were there?
Mostly worked on the new instrument, or the new interiors for the, at that time, the, what the heck's the name of their top of the line car over there now? Just, I can't think of it.
Sierra?
No, well, that, now it might be, yeah.
Oh, I see.
Then
it was. Cortina?
Fiesta? It was better than the Cortina. The Escort was the little one. With the reverse back window. And that was funny. When we were over there, they wouldn't sell me a car. I could buy one at a discount, but for some reason they wouldn't sell me one, even though I could. There was a 5-month wait for an Escort, and I wanted to buy an Escort. So I said, well, why don't I buy one, and when I sell it, if I sold it, you could easily get your money out of it, because there's. Everybody wanted one. They couldn't buy one.
Sure.
But anyway, they wouldn't. So I had to rent a car from Godfrey Davis, which was the Avis dealer over there. And I could never get the car washed. When it got dirty, I'd just take it back in and get another one. There weren't any car washes around London at all. Zero. And a fellow next door to us had a Maserati. No, it was a Aston Martin. And he used to wash his own, because that was the only way you did it. Everybody did that. Where was I?
You were working at Port of England then.
Oh yeah, trying to think of the names of the cars, yeah.
Yes.
Well, I thought of the name of the Escort, and that's not the one.
Not the Fiesta.
No, that was way before the Fiesta.
Yeah.
Oh, they had two different models, and one of them was like the really top, like the Cadillac of the Ford Motor Company. Isn't that ridiculous? I can't think of the name of it. Well, that was it anyway. And I was working on, with John Fallis on those interiors.
Still in the interiors, pretty much.
Mm-hmm. Over there, definitely, yeah. Definitely. Came back over here, and I was working for Dave Ash in the Lincoln Mercury production, or pre-production interiors.
Uh-huh.
And we did the, we modeled the, what turned out to be the 1964 Lincoln instrument panel. It was that was kind of unique too. It had the outboard air conditioning registers in a unique place. It was made right. The instrument panel itself look like it was floating.
Mm.
It turned out quite nicely, anyway.
How did you do that? How did you affect the floating?
Well, the concept of it was that there was if you took the armrest on the door and went ahead of the armrest on the door, there would be a flat spot for the ashtray. And you took that plane of that flat spot and just went toward the instrument panel and then angled up and went around behind the instrument panel and came back down the other side like a big racetrack.
Mm-hmm.
So when it angled up toward the instrument panel, we put the air conditioning grill in there. And then we floated a big box-like crash pad in the middle of this racetrack that went all the way around. And it just sort of floated there with the instruments and the center two air conditioning ducts and the glove compartment.
Was that all, some or all of your inspiration?
Well, that's always difficult to say.
Yeah.
Certainly, they're all group efforts.
Mm-hmm. Was Jim Quinlan involved in these at this point, or had he gone off to something else?
No, I don't think Jim was with me when we did that. I worked on that with a fellow named Dick Blair. Of course, Dave Ash.
Dave was the top interior man at that time, wasn't he? Or one of
well,
them, anyway.
He wasn't at that time. McGuire still was.
Oh, McGuire still
was. McGuire was head of interiors.
Oh, was he?
And he had Dave Ash and quite a few other, Art Miller and, my goodness, I can't remember how many other fellows working for him, including me.
This was the early 60s.
Mm-hmm. Early 60s, you know, let's see, 65, 66. Well, and I told you the Cove seat went into 64 Thunderbird, and that's about the last thing I had to do with the Thunderbird, I think, was that Cove seat.
Mm-hmm.
Although I did have a lot of them. We had the lease plan, and I managed to get one almost every year. And then, of course, the Mustang became the hot car. And I worked on the 67 Mustang Fastback. I did that.
Did you?
I was working for Dave Ash at that time. It was a different studio.
That was a good one.
And I did the Fastback. Someone else had already done the... No, I don't know. Maybe it was the whole car. I don't remember. But the one we did was a Fastback anyway. Maybe they took that and made the hardtop from that. I don't remember. Yeah, that turned out pretty nice. That Fastback turned out pretty nice. And then we worked on a lot of show cars. The La Galaxy show car was probably the wildest one. That had
tell us a bit about those various show cars, beginning with La Galaxy.
Well, when I first went to Ford, the show cars were really, to me, very exciting because I had never seen show cars before. And the one that, I may be wrong, but I think Joe Orris did the X100, which was a black... Well, it was almost like the, I think it was the 1960 Thunderbird.
Oh, was it?
It was almost a duplicate of the X100 show car. It had a kind of an aerodynamic front end and two huge bumper tail lights in the back that were supposed to simulate rocket fire coming out the back. Naturally,
yes.
Everything we did that. The only thing we didn't do was have smoke coming out the back. And then the other one at that time was the X500, I think, which Bill Schmidt did.
Oh.
Which actually was a better looking car. I think that was red.
What about the Continental 1950X? Do you remember that?
You mean the one that Reinhardt worked on?
Perhaps it was, John.
Or was it a show car, you mean?
Show car, yeah. It was the concept car from the early 50s of the Mark II.
called Continental 1950X.
Hmm. That doesn't ring a bell with me at all.
Uh-huh.
There were 52? The one that came out, was it 61, was the one with the nice smooth sides and...
No, this was a more arrow effect, looking toward the Mark II.
No, I don't remember that one. The Mark II was the one that Reinhardt worked on.
Right.
Yeah, and Bob Thomas.
Yeah. Bill Schmidt did the X500, huh?
Yeah.
That was an interesting car.
As far as I know, he did.
Yeah. And you worked on the X100?
No, I didn't work on either one of them. They were done when I got there.
Oh, when you got there?
Yes, or very shortly after I got there. I didn't have anything to do with that. That was sort of the inspiration for all the young designers, were those two cars.
Okay.
Then there was another one, it's called the Futura?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Ken Spencer had a lot to do with it.
I think so.
Double cockpit. That finally wound up being the Batmobile, I think.
Exactly, right. Yeah.
That's still around someplace.
A version of it, yeah.
Is that it?
Just sold recently for several.
Oh, did it?
$100,000.
I think the last time I saw it was when it was the Batmobile.
I think Schmidt was involved with that, too.
He probably was, because Ken would have been working for Schmidt.
Right.
Yeah. And maybe Bordenay, too, although it didn't look like Bordenay. Looked more like Schmidt.
The whole concept of the dream cars, which later became dream cars, was a marvelous laboratory, wasn't it, for designs?
Yeah, there were quite a few, for instance, that incorporated a parallel action side door, which was really an interesting concept. And unfortunately, it never got into production.
Mm. How did that work?
And never has, to my knowledge. The closest thing to it I can see is the sliding door on the side of the vans nowadays. But it was in that concept, it came out from the car first and then went... either forward or back, depending on which way you wanted it to go. It was sort of a half-hinged, half-sliding door. And it enabled you to get a very wide door and yet not have it stick out too far when you opened it on a parking lot. But it never came off, to my knowledge.
Was it ever incorporated into any production car that you know?
No, not that I know of. They put it on some prototypes, but never got on any production car that I know of. I think they were thinking of it at one time for the, I'm probably wrong, the 57 Ford retractable. But God, I had one of those, and that was the most impressive car. I used to park it in the driveway with the hood up and the trunk up and the roof halfway down, just to impress people that it looked like it was on the assembly line being assembled, you know.
What model was that again?
The 57 retractable hardtop.
Oh, yes.
All that huge trunk and no trunk room.
Filled up with motors, huh?
Filled up with motors and one little kind of a square bin in the center that you could put...
One small suitcase.
And God, if you ever had a flat tire, it was the most unbelievable thing. Did anybody ever talk about that?
No, tell us about it.
Well, number one, you had to take this metal bin out. That was for your luggage. Mm-hmm. You had to unbolt these wing nuts and take that out and either throw it over the side of the fin, because you're in the trunk. The trunk opened the other way, you know, from the front. So you had to get in the trunk to do that. You had to crawl over the fin to get in the trunk. Okay, then you either had to hand this thing to somebody outside or just throw it over on wherever you were. And then you had to take up a piece of plywood on the floor and get that someplace out of the way, and then you had to lift the tire out and lift that out over the fin and either hand it to somebody or whatever. Yeah, and then get the jack out of that hole. Then you had to climb out over the fin and do all the things that you have to do to change the tire and the wheel. Then you had to put the other wheel back in there and crawl back in and put all this stuff back together and have somebody hand you all this equipment.
Did you ever got to do it?
Once.
It's exactly the way it happened.
Right. Yeah. Fortunately, it was in the driveway.
Oh, good.
So I had my wife there to...
Good.
But it was I would hate to have to do that on the highway and on a rainy night, something like that. Far away.
There's some stories about how if one of the motors failed, the top would stop in midair. you had a huge clam halfway up and the top halfway down. And
it could happen, yeah. It could happen. I had it happen to me one time where the top wasn't up, but the I had gone to, we went to get a Christmas tree out in Birmingham, and we put the Christmas tree in the trunk, which was not made to take Christmas trees, because you had to leave it halfway open because it, as I say, it was a huge trunk, but it had all this junk in it. So we drove home from the Christmas tree.
Did you have a button that you could graduate?
On the inside, you could stop at any point you wanted to. So I had put the trunk, I put the Christmas tree in the trunk, and I closed the lid down to where it was just against the tree.
The clamshell.
Yeah, the trunk lid itself, the actual. And then I drove home, which was a couple of miles, and pulled it in the garage. Fortunately, the lid was down far enough so they could get in the garage. And then went to get the Christmas tree out, and the motors had frozen.
Oh, no.
It was so cold. It was below zero, you know.
Sure.
The motors had frozen, so I couldn't get the tree out. So I shut the garage door, and finally just wait till it warmed up enough to where they thawed out. And
you didn't emulate Henry Ford and take an axe to that deck lid.
No, I didn't know he did that. Really?
Well, back in the plastic deck lid days.
Oh,
back in the early 40s,
yeah. Oh, yeah, when he was trying to prove that that it was really strong.
Mm-hmm.
No, I never felt that bad about it.
Did it, well, it always seemed to be sort of a stepchild. Did it ever go? Was it popular? It ran for about 3 years, I think, didn't it? The retractable hard tub.
3 years, yeah. 57, 58, 59. They're collector's items now, but how they sold, I don't know. I think they sold about all they made.
Did they?
But I wasn't a big seller.
Yeah.
They made them. They assembled them down at the, I guess, what do they call it now? The pilot plant down there by Oakwood Boulevard?
Right.
Whatever they call it.
They call it the assembly plant.
Because it was Continental, and then it was, they did the retractable down there, and then the Edsel.
Edsel was down there for a while, yeah. Now it's the assembly division. Yeah.
Automotive assembly division.
Automotive assembly division,
yeah.
You may have mentioned this earlier on the tape, but whose baby was that? Whose idea was it, and who pushed it?
Well, as I mentioned way back in the beginning of the tape, the concept of it was from Gil Spear.
Well, that was his idea.
And
now, Gil Spear at that time was an executive, but
he was a manager or something like that. I don't remember the titles of what they had in those days. It was so long ago.
But he was fairly well up the ladder. Right?
They had this 3/8 scale working model of a retractable hardtop.
That's incredible.
And basically, the concept was almost exactly the same. Now, later on, I think I may be wrong, but it seems to me that a fellow named, an engineer named Smith, Bill? Isn't that ridiculous? I forget people's name. Forgot his name. Smith, I think, had a lot to do with the mechanism in the thing.
Yeah. Series of about 12 motors, weren't there? Eight?
I think eight sticks in my mind.
Eight motors, yeah, which controlled the various degrees of setting.
They were like on screw jack type things, and they would actually, you could stop it at any point.
Hmm.
Any point. There was no detents or anything like that.
This was controlled from the cockpit, or the.
Just by one
button.
Yeah.
Where was that located in the dashboard?
I think it was on the lower left. I don't remember. But if you pushed the button, if everything was shut and you pushed the button, the first thing that happened was the trunk lid went up.
And then one motion.
And when you got it to that point, if you, that's all you wanted, you just stopped pushing the button.
I see.
And if you wanted the top down, you just held it.
Ah.
And it just kept going.
Yeah.
But you could stop it at any point, whenever you want to. It was pretty well done, and of course, the concept of that they picked up for the convertible top on the T-Bird,
right,
and the Continental, the four-door Continental convertible.
Right. They didn't come up with the clamshell, but they came up with a modified version of it, did they not?
The roof was soft,
yeah, right.
But the trunk lid went up the same way.
Right.
Opened the same way, when the top was down, you didn't see anything.
That's
you
right.
didn't have a boot.
Yeah,
that kind
yeah.
of covered up.
That was Gil Spear's innovation.
I certainly think so.
He must have been able to push it successfully at the top level because
he had a lot of opposition. He was pushing it against the current.
Oh, was he?
Oh,
that's interesting.
Yeah.
What did the rest of the staff think about it? They thought it was impractical.
Well, they thought it was cute.
But no more than that.
But he didn't really get much backing from engineering until he did the 3/8. He was doing this sort of in secret, this 3/8 scale working model.
That was Gil's
when he got that done, you couldn't hardly fight the fact that it worked.
How did he ever put that tiny thing together with 8 little motors?
Oh, they had, they've got, Gil was very intelligent, and the head of the metal shop was really sharp, too. I think the fellow that worked on that wasn't the head of the metal shop at that time. That was Johnny Hay, who was a really sharp young fellow in the metal shop.
Mm-hmm.
That was his baby down there.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I mean, 3/8 scale is the size of this desk.
That's
big.
Right. I keep forgetting,
of
course. Yes.
The little tenth scale model that he had was about this long.
Uh-huh.
And that was working, too, but that just had a key in the side. You just turned the key,
and the
trunk went up, and the top went in it, and it shut.
But the 3/8
size,
fully
which is, you know, like 5 feet long or something like that. It was
marvelous.
All with the, well, I think, I don't, I guess it was batteries. I don't think you plugged it in. I don't remember. But it worked, and it worked great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's when they really, I don't think anybody got seriously interested in it at that time, but that's what spurred it on.
Fascinating.
Oh.
Well, the Thunderbird is behind you, and also the
67 Mustang.
The 67 Mustang, which was largely your work.
Did another interesting. Well, I did the 71 Mustang.
Oh.
71 Mustang.
What kind of innovations did that have in terms of?
Well, that was probably the wildest fastback. It had more slope on the rear window than.
By this time, the original 64 Mustang had ballooned. It had become rather large, had it not? Not quite. But
the 71, the 70. Well, let's see. The 65, 67, and up to 70. Were pretty much all the same size. They were pretty much. They might have been a little bigger.
What did the 71 have that the other didn't have?
Well, it was bigger for one thing. It was longer.
Yeah.
And it was. It was a kind of a different animal. It was a lot longer, and I guess I'd have to say sleeker looking. It didn't look cute like the original Mustang looked cute, which was great. And they look cuter all the time. I see them on the road. They look great. I saw a 71 convertible the other day that looked great, too.
Let's use the 71 Mustang as a sort of a test, or a sort of a capsule history. Tell us how it came about, whose concept it was to change it, whose idea was it to change it?
Well, again, we were working, I was in charge of a studio that we were working on advanced concepts.
Mm-hmm.
And I was I don't know if I can remember at that time. It was De La Rosa was the chief at the top, and somebody underneath him, it might have been Ken Nelson. It could easily have been Ken Nelson. And we were down in the basement, and I had this really nut of a stylist with me named Jim Kristich, who was really an excellent stylist, but he's kind of nutty.
How do you spell his name?
K-R-I-S-T-I-C-H? Kristich.
Kristich. Mm-hmm.
Something like that. And we were trying to get some new concepts for the new Mustang. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Not Thunderbird.
Yeah.
Mustang. And between us, we sort of came up with this really quite a side view that really had a sloping back window on it.
Mm-hmm.
To the point to where you'd think, well, nobody'd even think of it because you wouldn't be able to see out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we went ahead and did it, and some people liked it. I guess I don't remember who looked at it, but we managed to make a clay model of it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, eventually we made a fiberglass model of it, and we made two fiberglass models. And trying to think of what... I guess it was either a fastback and a hardtop, or it was a fastback and a Cougar version of the Mustang. I don't really remember which it was, but anyway, this one day we had him sitting up in the big studio up in the first floor in the new building. And that's about five bays, this studio was. And at that time, Bunky Knudsen had taken over.
As president from Lee
As Iacocca. President from Iacocca, but Iacocca was still there.
Mm-hmm.
And we, at that time, it was very touchy at that time. There was no love lost between the two, Iacocca and Knudsen. Anyway, it was a terrible snowy day in the winter, and they decided to have a show outside. And it was there were snow drifts outside the doors where they take the models out, so bad that the jacks, the high-low jacks that they put the models on, these heavy clay models, were getting hung up in the snow drifts, and they'd get stuck, and they'd have to get another high-low jack to pull them out. But nobody would say, well, we'll get a hold of Mr. Knudsen and say, well, we really can't have a show today.
Yeah.
It was, we're going to have the show today. And it was about, God, it must have been 8 inches of snow out there in the courtyard. And they got all these models out there, and the clay is freezing, and the Dynoc that they use for paint on the outside is getting hard and cracking, and the wind is blowing it off, blowing the paint jobs off. And when here comes Knudsen and Iacocca and everybody with their overcoats on and hats and scarves out there in the snow, walking around in the snow looking at these models. And neither Iacocca nor Knudsen would give up. I'm not going to say I'm cold. Anyway, they finally came in, the studios, and meantime, well, quite a bit of snow had blown in through the big doors in the studios too, and the floor was wet. And when they came in, they almost went on their tails because this floor was slippery. In fact, the secretary did. I thought she broke her neck in those high heels. But anyway, Knudsen came in, and you know, of course, Iacocca had the reputation of being the father of the Mustang.
Right.
He was certainly the one that pushed it. I would say the one that really designed it would be Dave Ash.
Really? Do you think he's the primary designer?
I give him credit for that. I certainly had nothing to do with it, that original Mustang. But anyway, Knudsen and Iacocca and all these people came in, and Knudsen walked by these two fiberglass models that we had sitting there.
Oh.
And he just out of a clear blue sky said, "There's your 71 Mustang." And that was it.
And that was yours?
Yeah.
Really?
That was
marvelous.
It. So I think Iacocca just was probably burning up. I don't know.
Well, now, was his candidate...
There weren't any other candidates.
Oh.
Nobody was working on it yet.
Oh, I see.
It wasn't time to work on it.
So
we'd done it early.
So what was in the courtyard were just your various...
Well, what was in the courtyard, I don't know what was out in the courtyard.
Oh,
it wasn't even Mustang. It was something else.
It was something else.
I don't know what it was.
It was the Friday show.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But,
yeah.
But then he came in and he saw your your mock-up and said, that's it.
Yeah, that was quite an unusual thing. I don't think that ever happened before.
Did they follow through on it?
It was almost exactly.
Really?
There were the modification you wouldn't have noticed.
Really?
And they even kept the big slope on the back window, which...
Now, don't leave that. This is a fabulous story. Now, so what happened right after that? What was the next 3 months, say, that happened?
Well,
after that?
Right after that, then they started to work on the models in the studio, in the production studio.
But using your model as the...
And as the base, yeah. That was always sitting there.
Yeah. Okay.
And they were doing... I really can't remember what those two models were. One of them was the fastback, and I can't remember what the other one was. But anyway, we started working on a Cougar version of that car, and also taking this Mustang and tuning it up so that it was feasible manufacturing wise, things like that. But I do recall that I was working on the Cougar version also, which it was the one with the tunnel backlight. It had sort of tunnel backlight that went sort of trailed out under the rear deck, and the grill, that narrow grill that wrapped up over, came up and bent over the top a little bit. Right.
Who had assigned you to do your model?
Well, it may have been Ken Nelson. It was still under Della Rosa. I remember that. But
this was still the advanced studio.
Yeah. Well, yeah. They called it. They had some other weird name for it. They had weird names for studios, like product development or
pre-production.
One was special project studio. I was always said on that special project studio. That's where I did the 67 Mustang. Iacocca had chocolate and strawberry, chocolate and vanilla studios, and he needed a strawberry studio, so that was it. We were the strawberry studio.
What did that refer to?
That he wanted a different three different proposals for one car from three different, totally different thinking, you know.
I see.
And not influenced by the other.
So the nickname came from.
Rather than doing three proposals in one studio and having them maybe all be variations of one design, he got three totally from different routes.
Not a bad concept.
No, it's an excellent concept. Yeah. As long as you got the money to pay for that kind of thing, why not do it?
Sure.
No, it was a good idea. So we were strawberry anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember who was chocolate and who was vanilla. I think that was Lincoln and Ford, Mercury and Ford, I guess.
Well, that must have been exciting for you.
It was, but it was a little touchy after that,
right?
Because we started working on the Cougar, and then we had an Iacocca side and a Knudsen side. And Iacocca would come and he'd look at his side, and Knudsen would come and he'd look at his side. And it was a little bit touchy.
A little tricky.
Right. But
this was in the late 60s. Knudsen came out in 68.
Well, I would have. That was a 71, so it must have been.
McGuire had retired, according to John Najar's chronology here.
Yes, that's true. Yes.
Yeah, and,
in fact, he came back while those models were in the studio just to say hello.
Did he really?
Yeah.
What did he say?
Hello.
He didn't say anything about the models. Huh?
Oh no, he didn't give a damn about
that.
No. He didn't care about that. Another weird thing we worked on in that studio was the what we called the Bedrock vehicle. And it started out to be a proposal for the lunar vehicle there was a competition to design that vehicle.
Oh, yeah.
And we got into it very late, actually too late to do anything, but it still sounded like an interesting project.
Uh-huh.
And I was working for a fellow named Barney Gardner, who designed the consoles at NASA. You know those things they got new ones now, but he designed the original ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Barney was a pretty interesting guy to work for, very flexible. Anyway, he decided that also a fellow named Dave Wheeler, who was the chief stylist, Barney worked for him, and I worked for Barney.
Chief stylist
of whatever the name of this studio was.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
Couldn't tell you what the hell the name of it was. Something like special projects or product development or some weird thing. And anyway, the concept of this vehicle was to build a vehicle after we gave up the lunar thing. We decided to build a vehicle that could be made in developing countries with very simple equipment, like a brake press, just to bend metal. So we designed it that way. And actually, we made the whole model out of foam core. I don't know if you know what foam core is, but it's two layers of paper filled with foam, and it comes in different thicknesses, eighth inch, quarter inch, half inch, and it's quite strong for what it is.
Good for making models of it.
Yeah, we built, since all these were flat planes anyway,
mm-hmm.
So we just built a wood framework, had a wood framework built with wheels and axles on it, and then we put bent simulated sheet metal over it in the foam core.
Yeah.
Put some seats in it, made an instrument panel. Simple, you know. I don't know if it even had a speedometer. It might have just had a water gauge and a temperature gauge and a oil gauge or something like that. I forgot. But that that went over pretty well, and they made a working model of it. They got an old, as I recall, it was a Fiat And they took the body off of it, and there was a rear engine at Fiat, and they made a new body out at Curran and Company, where they built a lot of our prototypes out there.
C-U-R-R-A-N?
No, C-A-R-R-O-N.
Oh, Carolyn, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Dolorosa has done a lot of, did a lot of things with Earl Brooks. Earl Brooks used to run it. He's dead now. He died about 6 months ago, I guess. And they built this out there and made a running model out of it.
Hmm.
And then they took it down to Eastern Market and ran it around there, down there, just to see what kind of reaction they'd get out of it. And they made a movie, a 16-millimeter movie, of the thing doing different things, running around the test track and going through Eastern Market and things like that.
Which vehicle was this again?
Well, we called it the Bedrock vehicle.
The Bedrock, okay. Why did you
call it?
It
finally wound up being called the T-Square.
For what reason?
Because it was in a sort of a concept of the Model T, and it was square.
Oh, okay.
That's the only reason I can think of.
And nothing to do with the draftsman's
device. No. Although that was a little bit of the cuteness in there.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, it wound up, the concept was taken to Australia, and they actually made a production car out of it to use exactly for that purpose.
Which was?
For in areas, well, it was kind of an all-terrain vehicle in some ways, but it was also, the concept was that it could be built in areas where the manufacturing facilities were very primitive, and by people who weren't too skilled. Now, whatever happened to that, I don't remember.
Port of Australia?
Yeah.
Take it over?
Yeah, that was when another wild guy was down there. Duncan McRae.
Oh, yeah, I heard about Duncan, yeah.
Duncan McRae.
Yeah.
He was, I think, chief designer down there when they did that.
Uh-huh.
But he got all his design of that from our model.
Oh, really?
He might not admit that, but he did. He did.
A utility vehicle.
Mm-hmm. They had a name. I can't remember the name of it.
For years, they used the word ute as an acronym mm-hmm. of utility. This is much later.
Yeah, I never heard that. Sounds reasonable, though.
Yeah.
And then,
The 67 Mustang was a very popular vehicle, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I had one of the fastbacks.
Did you?
Gee, I got it with it was silver and a black interior. It was a really nice car, but I got the big engine. A 390 engine. Mm. My God, it was way too much for that car. And I remember it was the first week I had it. I pulled into the gas station on the corner of Telegraph Road and Cherry Hill to get some gas. And I pulled out onto Telegraph Road, and I wanted to get out into the middle so I could make the next turn around the island and come back the other way. And I inadvertently just stepped on the gas a little too much, and I spun right out in the middle of the Telegraph.
Oh, no.
Oh, God, scary. You know. Fortunately, the light was red, and there weren't any cars coming. But, yeah, that was a hot... It looked hot, too.
Yes.
I bought another used one later on, and it had the same engine, 394 barrel. Oh, geez, my wife wouldn't drive the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Finally got rid of it.
And this is the beginning of the muscle cars, really.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, really. You didn't have to worry about gas in those days, that's for sure.
Well, what about the Knudsen episode with Larry Shinoda? Did that impact on your area at all?
The biggest, of course, that this was this had a lot of influence on a lot of people,
mm-hmm.
and there was a lot of animosity.
Right.
Larry had a studio right next to the one that I was working on when we did the Mustang. Now, at the time that Larry was at his peak, or almost at his peak, we were working on a car called the Phoenix, which turned out to be the Pinto.
That was the code name.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we were all doing models of that car. Mm-hmm. And I was working on that too. I was working for Ken Nelson at that time. I was a manager under him. And, or was it Queerfeld? Maybe it was Art Queerfeld. I think it was Art, no, it was one or the other anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Art Queerfeld was the one who used to like to stay till 3 o'clock in the morning.
Never went home.
Well, he used to go home at dinner time, then he'd come back.
I see, then work another 8 hours.
Yeah, it's like Saturdays. I worked for him one time, when son of a gun, Buzz Grissinger.
Yeah.
On a Saturday, Art would come in when the modelers came in at 7:30 in the morning or 7 o'clock, and he'd bring donuts in. See, and he'd stay for about a half an hour, and I'd have to be there so I wasn't late. And he'd bring donuts in, and I'd be there, and then he'd go and play golf.
Oh, my.
And then in the afternoon, about 2:30 or so, Grissinger would come in, and he was the executive stylist, or above Queerfeld, chief, I guess. And so I would have to stay there till absolutely quitting time. And I wasn't getting paid for overtime. I didn't, it was free as far as I was concerned. But they had me trapped into coming in first thing in the morning and leaving last at night. So anyway, Queerfeld was that way. But we were working on the Phoenix, and which turned out to be the Pinto. And of all the models that were there, and I don't remember how many there were probably six anyway. Maybe eight, I don't know.
Six concept models?
Yeah, they had a show, and Knudsen and Shinoda were walking up looking at these models, and I don't remember if Iacocca was there or not, but they were walking up, and Shinoda had brought a sketch with him, a little rendering, sort of, and he had it on an easel. And he got Knudsen to agree that that's the way they ought to go, that sketch. And basically, that was the Pinto.
Really? It was really his?
It's awfully close.
What were the rest of the models? Did they take any bits and pieces from them that you people had set up?
Well, I suppose you could, they were all the same size, but I, to my recollection, and this may be wrong, that basically his design was
Shinoda's.
Pretty much different than the other ones. And then we worked on that one. We worked on the Pinto with Queerfeld and brought it into feasibility and things like that.
There was a general feeling, obviously, that a small car was the next way to go. And
well, I always liked that. I always liked small cars. My son had a Austin Mini Cooper, which was the first front-wheel drive mini car.
Really?
And that thing was utterly fantastic, just fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
So I always thought that was the most, that was only 10 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
Car. It's smaller than anything they're making now. It's even smaller than the little three-cylinder ones that they have, GM and those two-seaters and stuff. But, everybody pretty much thought that we should have a compact car. I don't know why. I guess the gas was maybe getting a little high. I don't know.
This is the early 70s.
Yeah. Well, when the first Pinto was in 70, wasn't it? Or 71?
Right, yes,
70
yes.
Or 71,
late
yeah.
60s,
yeah.
Aside from that, which is considerable, what impact did Shinoda have on Ford design?
Well,
aside from the Pinto.
Let's see, the only thing I can remember is, of course he had a lot to do with the racing.
Well, that's right. Yes.
Competition stuff.
Uh-huh.
And he did, as far as design goes, I think he had a lot to do with the Torino.
Oh.
The one that he first worked on had a kind of target like grill. It had a nose that stuck out in the middle, and he had a lot to do with that Torino. I don't remember what year that was. must have been 70, 71, around in there someplace. But I'll tell you that the last days of Knudsen were weird.
Really? How so?
Well, I try to put it back together. I was working for Dave Wheeler, who was a Knudsen man. He was brought in by Knudsen.
Oh, was he?
And he was whatever the name of that studio was I was working in. I don't whatever that was.
Mm-hmm.
Corporate Projects, I think it was, or something. Special Development or some weird thing like that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, our studio was separated from Shinoda's studio by one of the folding walls we have over there.
Right.
And it goes up so many feet and then it's open over the other side. I don't know, 12 feet or something like that, whatever. And a lot of people, I was going to say everybody, hated Shinoda. He was a very obnoxious